like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Yuen Wang, co-founder of American Marine Research Company, a cadre of hotshot young engineers, graduates of schools like Princeton and MIT, whom you might expect to find in Silicon Valley about to become super wealthy from their first startup there. Instead, Wang and his colleagues have settled in Pensacola, developing underwater drones to target lionfish, a rampant invasive species. While the most high-profile invasive species in the country is probably still the Burmese pythons in the Everglades, lionfish are flourishing. They have no natural predator and pose a serious ongoing threat to ecosystems in the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. Inter-American Marine Research Company, which has been designing robots that can hunt lionfish at greater numbers and in deeper waters than human divers or any other lionfish combatants can do. We'll hear about how American Marine Research Company came together to target lionfish, the work they've done to develop these underwater drones, what the project's looking like at the moment, and more when I speak with Yuen Wang in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll also speak with Carlos Munoz, a staff writer at the Sarasota Herald Tribune, who's been covering the controversy that's erupted over the drowning death of Snooty, the 69-year-old much-beloved manatee who died July 23rd after becoming trapped in a maintenance tube at the South Florida Museum Parker Manatee Aquarium. Protesters last weekend were calling for the firing of the museum's CEO and CO. So more about that later in the program. Also, a programming note, later this afternoon, I will be hosting a music show sitting in for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music, 2 to 4 p.m. right here on 88.5 FM WMNF. Right now, though, let's get to Yuen Wang and the efforts to create an underwater drone to help eradicate lionfish, with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Yuen Wang on Talking Animals. Good morning, Yuen.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So, of course, I'm eager to hear all about the efforts you and your colleagues have devoted to creating and developing this underwater drone, and we'll absolutely come back to that and explore it fully in a moment or two. But maybe that would be putting a little bit of the cart before the horse. Let's begin by telling me a bit about your colleagues. For example, let's start by discussing how graduates of Princeton, MIT, Cornell, and Olin College of Engineering came together. How did you guys first all meet?
That's what I found was reasonably remarkable about this story. One of the many things, for one, I didn't know them at all, you know, 5 months ago. Initially it was just a hobbyist project, right? I'd shut down the last software startup I'd been working on. I knew that in my heart with this summer after graduating Ivy League school, whereas a lot of my peers, would be traveling Europe or Southeast Asia, blowing their signing bonuses, I found that a little bit less inspiring, and I wanted to learn something. And so I thought, I read a lot. I'm reasonably eclectic, I'd like to think. So, and this stood out to me as a problem where, oh, great, this is something where I think technology could be applied with as relatively low-hanging fruit. And as I did more research, I began to realize that this is not well-suited for a hobbyist project, in particular the magnitude of the problem, the sheer scale of it, really asked for a more earnest effort than, just a summer-long hackathon. And to that end, I realized I needed to start building a team, and it was indeed going to be an experiment, not just in whether the tech would work, but whether you could assemble a team remotely and inspire them remotely to get on board with this vision. And so I reached out to a lot of people I met through entrepreneurship competitions, through hackathons, through the MIT Media Lab, through individuals like Alex K. Chen, and just people who contribute a lot on Quora, and ultimately found, a number of resumes. But, I'm a mathematician by training, so again, I think the story is not where how we assembled, but how I managed to beg for help for people to carry me in that you know, I asked for some professors and alumni to help me do the technical vetting, because as a mathematician, I really didn't feel qualified to judge individuals on their technical skills. You know, I think we got really lucky, right? Like we found a couple of individuals, many individuals who were very talented, technically skilled, and it was actually quite hard to choose. That were willing to try it out for a summer, right? And I think, you know, that's really where how interesting the problem is kind of spoke for itself. Like, who else gets to build, like, weaponized drones over your summer to hunt a really worthy adversary? And also to, you know, work with a team that is also pretty enthused about the zaniness of this problem. And, you know, as someone that grew up in a little beach town outside of L.A., and, you know, Duncan, who went to high school in Hawaii, I think we can all appreciate that clean and healthy oceans are one of those things they don't really appreciate until they're gone. So I suppose in short, it was unconventional. I think looking upon our work so far, it has worked out. We've been tremendously fortunate that it worked out.
So a couple things I'd like to maybe clarify. First of all, the Duncan you referred to is not me. It's one of your team members who... Just because there's so few Duncans around, sometimes you got to clarify. So let's back up a little bit. So you recognize this thing is more sprawling and has more scope and depth than a hobbyist project, and you're not less intrigued because of that. You're more intrigued. So then you thought, hey, I'm going to need help. And so you put out your SOS. Was the SOS that ultimately drew your three, I guess, principal colleagues, was it, hey, here's this situation with lionfish. I'm going to try to do this summer. I don't know where it's going. I don't know if there's any kind of pay or compensation really at this point. There's probably not, but come on down. I mean, is that essentially what the pitch was?
I mean, it's, I should say that it wasn't without pay, right? And I think it was more on the basis where, you know, one thing I think where a lot of engineers don't get an opportunity to explore on their own. And indeed it was, you know, that was me a few, a bit ago, not too long ago, where you really don't have the luxury to select your own projects and just work on something on your own. So to the extent to which I was able, you know, we were all able to, you know, pull together and help individuals that, you know, that came from lower income backgrounds within our team. And something I think made it easier for everyone to come down.
But still, it's interesting because as I've noted when telling people a little bit about you guys and getting the word out a little bit about the show, given that you guys are all recent graduates of Princeton, MIT, Cornell, Olin College of Engineering, you could reasonably expect to find that same group in, let's say, Silicon Valley, getting ready to cash in on the IPO of your first big hotshot startup there, and instead you're in Pensacola working on this. I mean, so now that it's clear that it's not a hobbyist thing, and I'm guessing that even those three colleagues that have joined you now see that this is more than a summer proposition as well. What is the view amongst you and your colleagues now? Like, where do you see this going, and why are people still just going to forge ahead?
Could you repeat the last part?
How do you really see it now as opposed to how you saw it earlier and even maybe how you presented it to the three that have joined you versus like how it looks now? I mean, to me, I would guess it looks like, hey, this is kind of an ongoing bigger thing even than I realized when I realized it wasn't a hobbyist thing. It sounds like this is something that's going to be kind of open-ended now, right? Is a project you guys are just going to continue to work on?
Yeah. First off, I should say, I firmly believe, and I always say, I'd rather see a project succeed without me than fail with me. Way I see my role in this, I'm going to do what I think I can do well that nobody else is willing to do right now. But you know, if there is a point in time where the team doesn't need me anymore, and in fact, it is my intention to return to Hedge Fund Bridgewater Associates, to which I'm currently signed. This might be able to get a deferral to wrap up my work here. As for, you know, right now, a lot of things are in a state of disarray. The summer's coming into end. We're trying to raise some money from the conservation community, or find some conservation-based grants to accelerate a few efforts, because our last sea trial was unsuccessful. As for where it diverged from our original view, I mean, we came out here with 10 weeks of with a 10-week runway. We just thought we'd hack out this drone. It wouldn't have to be pretty; it would just have to work. And you know, many parts of it did work. And like, we came to learn. Indeed, is hardware is hard. It was certainly a good reminder in that. But also, I think what was very remarkable is how friendly the community has been out here. I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to school in New Jersey, and was fortunate enough to be welcomed into many beautiful communities. But the community of Pensacola in particular, seeing the individuals that have weathered hurricanes, that weathered economic downturn and oil spill, it's been really inspiring to see that level of friendliness, even offered to us as very much newcomers. And initially we were thinking, we had a website for a little bit. We took down that website actually for a while because we didn't really want to respond to a bunch of emails. We just felt like PR was one of the, we just didn't see any value in PR. We didn't see any value in aesthetic. Just wanted to build the drone and be done with it. But we do a little bit more of that now, in that I think it's a fun story. At least it provides entertainment value to people to hear about it. We've also had the opportunity to take on a good number of interns that we originally were, thought we tried out, but since then we've come to be blown away that, like, hey, it's even though we're not too far out of school ourselves, the extent how we can help individuals who have an interest in technology and marine conservation and in the region, that's deeply rewarding. So yeah. I suppose the short answer is that sorry for rambling, but to sum it up, we came to discover that it's more than just the lionfish that we're hunting.
Well, let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Yuen Wang, co-founder of American Marine Research Company, which is developing underwater drones to target lionfish, a rampant invasive species with no natural predator. If you'd like to ask Yuen a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So I guess one of the questions then is, with the three colleagues that you drew, I mean, you mentioned that you are a mathematician by training. Do the other three each have distinctly different yet complementary skills to pursue this project?
Yes. Ian, our electrical engineer, is an electrical engineer. Ian Schweitzer is an electrical engineering student at Cornell. Is just a tremendous roboticist, especially for his age. And was also an early adopter of 3D printing, and that's been really helpful to us. Taylor and Jaka, our mechanical engineering grad out of MIT. He was on their marine robotics team and was a former world robotics champion. Again, very strong roboticist. Duncan Michael, our mechanical engineer out of Olin. He a lot of experience in competitive robotics as well. And all the individuals which I mentioned have had extensive experience in competitive robotics, building fast and not seeking not elegance, but just to accomplish the task at hand.
Yeah, well, that does sound like a pretty high-octane crew there you've got. So once you kind of got those guys interested and they said, yeah, we'll come down for the summer or whatever and check it out and get involved. I mean, while still in the discussion stage or the analysis stage even, I guess, what were the fundamental challenges that the four of you, I guess, faced when, like, okay, how can we tackle most effectively the lionfish problem?
Yeah, sure. Really, I think what was quite comforting was, for all this uncertainty, was that we really had narrowed, before we even started building, we had narrowed it pretty much down to just an engineering challenge. We just needed to catch the fish, and we'd watch hours of YouTube videos of divers observing these lionfish and seeing how they responded to divers with pole spears. We just had to catch the fish. The rest, like the ability to find a wholesaler to catch the lionfish that we harvested, that ecosystem, that had the business side of it, as it were, really seemed to be, after a little bit of research, seemed to be taking care of itself. It was just building the drone that would work. There were concerns. There's a lot of learnings within there, like, given the salinity of the water, how does that affect any sort of electrofishing mechanism that we wanted to attempt? Given the salinity of the water, how can we expect our thrusters to degrade, or what sort of depth ratings would he really seek to achieve, and how effective was the computer vision? How can we translate a simpler computer vision problem into actually mobilizing the drone? But I think that what was really fun was that you didn't have to worry about anything else. Every one of us believed, and we still believe, that all you have to do is just get the drone to work.
Let's just back up for a sec. I probably should have done this or asked you to do this a bit ago, but some people, of course, that are in around Florida listening are probably quite familiar with lionfish, but there are a lot of people who listen online or later listen by way of archives that are all parts of the country and even other countries in some cases. So maybe you could just take a moment and just describe what a lionfish is and its key attributes and how it became a problem and how it became an invasive species.
Absolutely. So lionfish are a species of fish originating in the Indo-Pacific. They measure between 9 to 18 inches as adults. Closer to 12 inches in most cases. And they have venomous spines. So that doesn't really make it so that it deters a lot of natural predators. They're really beautiful for it. But unfortunately, they also, everything in moderation, they definitely don't have a sense of moderation. Each female lays, up to 2.3 million eggs per year, and they're sexually mature in 10 months. So the doubling rate on that, if you assume certain egg viability, it's pretty insane. And they've come to be found off the coast of New Jersey, as well as far south as Brazil, in just a matter of years after, they were first dumped off some private aquariums around Sarasota.
Just so we're clear, that's how they began. Is people had them in their aquariums and for whatever reason said, hey, we're done with this, or I don't want to look after them anymore, or whatever, and then just dumped them in the ocean.
That is the standing hypothesis. So for a while, people believed that maybe they came in ballast. But, they're very popular as aquarium fish because they're very hardy.
Yeah, and it's not unlike, for example, the Burmese python that people are even more probably familiar with in terms of invasive species where people had them as pets. They were small, they were manageable, and then they were neither of those things. And people just took them to the Everglades or wherever they decided to let them loose, and now we have a huge problem with those in the Everglades. So, so that's kind of the basic history and sort of the description of lionfish. So they don't have, as I think I mentioned, they don't have any kind of natural predator. So that's part of why, in addition to the incredible reproduction rate you just described, there's nothing working at containing their population at all.
Some grouper and barracuda have been identified to attack wounded ones, but not at any significant scale where you can even begin to classify them as regular menu items on a grouper's diet.
With that in mind, so what was the first drone? What was your earliest effort at a drone like? What did you guys seek to do at the first stage of this?
The earliest model was, at a big metal cylinder with a bunch of thrusters attached to it, as well as a camera in the front, and the hope was just to either via electrostun or via some arm grabbing mechanism, just shove it down the tube into some containment unit. It was basically like a glorified wastebasket. Since then, there are only so many ways that I think after speaking with a lot of advisors and plenty of brainstorming, there only seems to be a pretty finite number of ways to approach the problem. We don't know to which one's going to work best yet, which is why we're developing so many prototypes in parallel and building as fast as we can. We'd like to leave the field trials to be the ultimate judge of what works best.
Okay, well, I want to come back to some of those prototypes in a sec, but we've gotten already a handful of emails and some calls, so let's get to some of those right now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Yuan Wang.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder if he's concerned at all about the weaponization of his product once he's completed it.
Okay, Yuan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'm very worried about that. Right, as an engineer, you care about the full life cycle of your product, and if you think about what we were developing, especially from the perspective of artificial intelligence, as well as a handful of our more longer-ranged weapons, you can abuse these and attack other fisheries. And maybe in the United States we have protections against that abuse, but in other countries where the fishing regulations are less well enforced, we're deeply concerned that this could hurt other fish stocks. And more than that, they're even within lionfish, if you had developed this technology and just gave it into the hands of many parties, you'd be incentivized to actually honeypot and to farm, just to go after the big fish and leave behind the small fish. And it's actually the small fish you want to catch, right? Because they're the ones that are going to eat the other smaller slipper lobster and grouper and red snapper larvae. And they're also the ones that have the longest expected lifespan going forward. But if you did that, if you caught all the big fish, it would actually make it harder for a second party to go up and clean up only the small fish, because that would be less profitable. It'd be better off if you had a party that was looking to create just a self-sustaining model where you caught all the big fish and the small fish in one pass while you're already out there, which is already really expensive to get out there. And it's also, motivates why, I'm happy to talk about some of these prototypes at a high level, but we don't. We hesitate from whereas in a lot of other projects we're pretty happy to open source, we're hesitant against you're just making all this freely available. And we're hesitant to about you actually even even selling the drones. We intend to handle the operations ourselves, working with fishermen and charter captains and conservationists that we trust to make sure this technology is deployed responsibly.
All right. Well, that touches on at least two or three questions I was going to ask, and at least one question that one of our emailers asked. I mean, one of my questions, which you sort of touched on a little bit, but I just maybe could get you to expand a little bit on this. I was curious, like, how the drone does identify a lionfish and how it distinguishes it from, say, a grouper or a red snapper or fish that are commonly in the same area.
Yeah. So the So what we're working on right now, for those of us with a background in computer science, we're using, as was pretty standard, a 7-layer convolutional neural network. Basically, you can think it's not mathematically, it's not quite rigorous to describe it as that, but you can think of it kind of like a digital retina. Again, it's not at all like that, but it allows you to detect objects that it's like a pattern recognition, but allows for some invariance in terms of spatial location and naturally handle some normalizations.
Okay, so it sounds like for those of us who aren't steeped in computer science as you guys are, that with that digital retina, it helps identify, hey, here's a lionfish, as opposed to here is actually a grouper or a red snapper, and so then that steers the drone or directs the drone accordingly.
Yeah, and that problem actually turned out to be reasonably easy.
Okay.
To the identification process, we don't really make any. The program doesn't make any mistakes. It occasionally misses some lionfish, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't ever suggest bycatch.
Okay, so and then this brings me to one of our emailed questions, which it says, "I know lionfish are invasive, a problem introduced by humans here, but is killing them ethical? Is there no other way to control their population?"
I'm sure there's other ways to control their populations, right? We know that in the Indo-Pacific there are parasites that help with controlling the populations. I think maybe we'd like to try the drone before we go and dump parasites out into the Gulf of Mexico, just for solving the lionfish problem. And I'm sure there's other methods. We're quite open to trying a number of methods. This is the one that we're developing now, and even within drones, we're trying a bunch of different things. We're not going to be so arrogant as to believe that just by theorizing at a table, we're going to come up with a solution. But let it stand to see trial. As for the ethics of it. I suppose this is where I might diverge from a lot of individuals in the conservation community. I believe that as a Christian, I believe that human life is the only sacred life. And to that end, there's value to other life, but the idea of sanctity is, I think, is something you reserve for truly what's sacred, right? And to that end, I don't give a whole lot of value to animal life.
Well, that's certainly an interesting, and it does diverge from various things, including probably the fundamental operating philosophy of this show, but that's exactly why we have these kind of exchanges and have welcome people to email and call in. And in fact, let me read another email here that says, this is a fascinating topic. Lionfish are unbelievably prolific in appetite and breeding. How many lionfish have been eradicated so far with the drones? And there's other questions here, but let's leave it at that.
Well, thank you. We also find it quite fascinating. We're very lucky to have the opportunity to work on a problem like this. It's zero. We haven't. Our first sea trial was unsuccessful. We arrived here on June 9th. After setting up the 3D printers and our office space that was lent to us by very generous Brian Clark at the Coastwatch Alliance. We've still been building. It's been there's still we like to think that we have a sea trial coming up in the next week or two. We haven't caught any fish yet, but we think we're very close.
And so let me see if I have this right, that where you may be going with this. And I know you said you didn't really want to talk about the prototypes in too much detail, in the same way that several days ago when I asked you to maybe send me a few pictures I could use to help promote the show, you weren't really keen on sharing images of the drone, just because I guess you guys hadn't filed for patents on it and you're still working on it. So I assume in that same way, some of your description might be just inherently kind of limited in that way. But is the idea, as you're working on different kinds and sizes, is the idea later, in other words, what you're striving for, is the idea to, you already mentioned that you guys would still retain control of the drones, or so I guess allow fishing or conservation organizations to use it with your kind of direct supervision, which goes back to our first caller's concern. So is that one way, is another way to license their use separately? And is the other idea that when this is in full swing, that the idea would be, at least in part, to harvest the lionfish and sell them to seafood distributors or restaurant chains and stores? Because, again, as some people who may not be familiar with lionfish may not know, as much as they're poisonous in their spines and their things, I guess, excuse me, a lot of people do consider them quite a good fish or delicacy as a fish. So is that part of where the various uses of this and where some the financial end of it later it rests?
Yeah. So as for partnerships, you know, that's not immediately clear to us where there isn't a roadmap that's set in stone. We'd like to think that there are parties out there that are willing to partner with us. And if not, we'll figure it out. I don't have the most elegant answer for that. There's no excuse not for having answer. But at the end of the day, I'm a 23-year-old college student, graduated more like 8-9 weeks ago. I only started working on this project fairly recently. The second part of the question was?
I'm not sure in which order that went. I was just, I guess, looking at the projected uses as the drone gets developed, and would there, in fact, be more than one drone, like one drone maybe have a certain function?
Oh, yeah. So, Ensemble Robotics, you know, using multiple drones that fill different roles together, I think is a direction that we're keen on looking at. You know, you might have lionfish that are caught in some small crevice. You need a particular type of weapon to remove them. Whereas if they're caught out in the open, we might have something that's more efficient for that. It is our intention to hopefully not have to rely on grants and just burn it to sustain it. And hopefully we can harvest enough lionfish that'll be self-sustaining.
Okay, again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking to Yuen Wang of American Marine Research Company, which is developing underwater drones to target lionfish and invasive species with no natural predator. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's get another caller involved. Hi, you've been waiting a long time. You're on Talking Animals with Yuen Wang.
Yeah, got to tell you, the idea that humans are sacred and we're the only sacred species, scientifically, we are the number one invasive species. The lionfish only are out of their natural habitat zone because of us. What we do to the Gulf and other water resources in fishing, boating, jet skiing, pollution development, if you wanted to use your drones to really help nature, native ecosystems, native flora and fauna, and humans, you would be using your drones to look at the crab traps in the Gulf, what it feels like for a manatee or a dolphin to be out there with all these boats and jet skis. It is, I tell you, my man, the idea that humans are the only species that counts, the only, quote, sacred species, totally opposed to the science and the real ethical viewpoint of most of the listeners of this show.
Okay, well, I don't know if you'd like to respond to that, Ewan, or not.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think I'd like to redact the comment. I mean, the extent to which is possible in the digital age, the idea that, saying that human life, that animal lives weren't valuable, I just do. I suppose that comes from a lot of frustration that, last year, 6.2 million people died of starvation, 400,000 of malaria, and those are more people than I ever meet in my life. You know, at the same time, I see, not that I should, like he without sin cast the first stone, you kind of seeing a lot of people donating, say, like animal shelters and the other things, which, you know, is totally valid and all, but to put it into perspective, it just seemed out of line with me. So I suppose, you know, I apologize. It's no excuse, but I'm a little bit sleep deprived. And, that's maybe where the frustration is coming from. I agree, you know, from that perspective, humans do cause a lot of damage. And, as a first world consumer, I'm just as guilty as anyone else. And as for the manatees getting caught in, crab traps, I can't say I was aware of that problem until now. I mean, again, no excuse, but moved very recently to the area. And as I mentioned, a priority this summer was to learn, And so thank you for teaching me something new.
Okay. Well, thank you, caller, for your comments, and thank you, Ewan, for your response. So I gather, but maybe this is based on something I mentioned earlier, a faulty assumption, but are you guys aware that other companies or individuals are working on either with the same technology or with entirely different technology, perhaps, tackling this problem in at the same on the same kind of path or timetable that you guys are?
Yeah. So there's a robotics and service of the environment that we, you know, they test a lot out of Bermuda, and there's also Atlantic Lion Share. They also are testing out of Bermuda. RSC is a nonprofit, and Atlantic Lion Share, I believe, is a for-profit entity. We try to reach out to them initially, asking, like, you know, how can we, you know, can you guys teach us a few things about these things? We'd like to help, at least RSC. And there have been some academics around the country who have worked on similar projects, but at least with RSC, maybe, you know, they didn't think that my emails were responding to you, and I think it was a little bit hard to get in touch with them, and, you know, maybe, the, you know, I understand that they're busy, or, you know, maybe progress moving slow, but I suppose the short answer is we felt if you want something done right, you do it yourself. And more than that, you know, because we're selling lionfish, it's not a differentiated product, we don't are really too worried about, you know, like the idea of a competitor, right? We came out here very mission-driven. If people solve the problem for us, the problem is still solved, we at least felt that we tried and to do our part.
Right. Well, it sounds like, if I follow you, though, that your overtures to some of those other entities were more about cooperating and some shared information, at least on some level, not serving as competitors, at least in the initial communications that you attempted.
Yeah. I mean,
But it sounds like they perceived it maybe the other way around, if they're not responding or.
I think Atlantic Lion Share has been, in a handful of conversations I've been able to have, they've been quite friendly. I just can't say that it was, you know, competitive analysis was something that we took, maybe we should have, that we really studied or analyzed that carefully.
Okay, gotcha. So in our remaining moments here, Ewan, you've alluded to some tests that have failed or haven't, I guess, yielded the results you guys were hoping for. So maybe, again, I know there's certain limitations on what you guys feel comfortable saying, but can you just give us, in whatever way you can, sort of a little bit of a summary of kind of the key things that you guys have tried so far and what kind of things, based on those initial tests, that you are refocusing on or refining?
I mean...
Or is it just a general conversation put you outside of what you're comfortable in terms of proprietary information?
No, it's not even that. It's just like, you know, we're caught up in that big moment, and I suppose that might be a, you know, fault of my generation as a whole, that we aren't very reflective, and I just haven't had an opportunity to reflect on where the journey really lay. I know, you know, incrementally we just came out here with some designs with you know, cylinder based designs as well as, you know, spear based designs. And just started building. A lot of things that we learned are really just technical. I mean, it's on some parts, you know, the problem is very tricky. Looking back right now, I really don't feel like I can. It really just feels like a blur of a bunch of putting out fires and late nights hacking. I wish, but now that you mentioned, I should go back and reflect on kind of think of the key milestones.
I guess that's partly what I was asking, because you said earlier in the conversation that you guys arrived here June 9th, so we're at August 9th today, 2 months. So I just figured along the way there may have been some things, even if they didn't quite turn out the way you'd hoped on some of these tests, that then you may have spun you in like, okay, well then maybe this is what we have to do if we're going to try to get to this result. I assume it's just kind of an ongoing process in that way.
Yeah. I mean, milestones are oftentimes where it's now when you say it, like some of these milestones, you're like, oh, that should be trivial, like just getting some parts of the electronics to work or getting the firmware to support, you know, certain pieces of hardware or to get this drone to move extremely quickly or even to just get some components waterproofed. Like all those are, you know, small milestones, but they meant a lot to us at the time, and we still look upon them fondly. But, you know, because we're that early, we haven't, certainly when we catch a fish and we have successful sea trials and hit certain efficiencies, you know, hopefully we'll get there. That'll be worth celebrating, but I certainly think it might be too early to really look upon anything we've done as, you know, as being a big milestone. it's all we're left to do, and we intend to do it.
Okay, well, instead of maybe looking back so far at the 2 months, let's look ahead a month or two, because it sounds like from what you were saying in the initial part of our conversation that at some point your time there may come to an end just because the hedge fund that I guess has already hired you is probably looking to have you report to work at some point. So just looking ahead a little bit, a month or two, what do you see that way? I mean, do you see extending your time there, or are you going to come to a natural end where you'll have to leave the team, but the other three will stay put? I mean, what does it look like just on kind of almost on a personnel level?
I have no idea. It's I mean, that's what's reasonably scary. Very scary is that, you know, whether there's going to be the whether there's going to be the funding to support the continued operation of it. I'd like to think that we can find it if we're resourceful with time. As for whether, I think, you know, it's a decision that certainly if we're at this age, we involve our families in deciding and helping us decide what makes sense. The worst case is where our engineers will go back to the Northeast, and you know, our engineers will continue to develop a drone, and I'll find some way to hand off my role. I mean, I suppose that's the least glamorous part, I suppose, about bootstrapping a little project like this, is that rarely can even look 1 week ahead and know with certainty what's going to happen.
But it sounds like over the course of our time that you feel pretty hooked in and pretty committed. So I just wondering, for example, like, can you kind of hold off given that passion that's even maybe greater than you felt it would be when you first sent out your pleas for help to people that landed your three colleagues? I mean, can you hold off the Bridgewater and Associates, or is there a certain time to where they say, hey, well, this is great, we support what you're doing, but we do need you back by September 15th or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I don't know any.
Okay.
I haven't even actually sent an email to ask about that, though I suppose
okay.
I'm a cat out of the bag in this sort of deal. I like to, well, I need to, I think it is going to take some reflection on whether, you know, asking if I have the ability to, you know, if this were possible, if I'm the one that, you know, best suited to lead this, and if I did ask for a year off to, you know, basically continue to learn and to explore in this way, if it'd really be worth it, because I'm deeply grateful for having a job after graduation, and I don't want to. I worry a lot that it comes off as ungrateful when I explore as I do.
Maybe so, but you also sound very much like a guy who really doesn't want to leave anytime soon.
I don't know if I'd be entirely, I mean, yeah, it'd suck. I love Pensacola. I love this project. But I also really enjoyed, interning at Bridgewater Associates.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very grateful for having both opportunities. And I, you know, it's Bridgewater Associates was a commitment, and I don't like this. I don't renege upon those commitments.
Sure. Well, you're in a, sounds like a pretty glorious spot where, like, whichever direction you go, it sounds like you're going to be happy and fulfilled. There'll just be probably very different enterprises.
Indeed. I hope so.
Okay. Well, Yuen, we're sort of reached the end of our time, and we've been speaking again to Yuen Wang, American Marine Research Company based in Pensacola. So we will keep an eye out and maybe do a little follow up down the road and see where you are and what's happening with the project and any other updates we can have at that time. So meanwhile, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Carlos Munoz of the Sarasota Herald Tribune to get an overview about the uproar about the death of Snooty, the famous and much-beloved manatee who died recently in what some say were negligent circumstances. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from Eddie Izzard called Parrots. It's Eddie Izzard now. Today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Long John Silver had an eye patch. What a cool guy. Also had a parrot on his shoulder. Parrots have never been in. They've never been hip because they suffer from the bimbo bird syndrome. They have great-looking feathers, blues, and really primary colours that kick out, but they look great, talk shite. That's their problem. Hello! 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 That's all they say. On occasion, pieces of eight. And pieces of eight is the equivalent of a bird on your shoulder going, a tenner. A
tenor. A tenor.
Can you shut up, Bird, about the money?
A tenor.
Minor Bird, that's what you want on your shoulder. Black feathers matches your eye patch. Minor Bird say cool things like, oh, look at that sunset. That's my Minor Bird. Is that an Aurora Borealis? Or am I a Dutchman? And birds fly, and we have aeroplanes, so that's the okay deal. But I think we have a fascination about hang gliding. When I remember seeing when James Bond did that hang gliding thing with the engine at the back, and we like the hang, ooh, I think everyone would like to hang glide, but we're just worried about that PAF bit, where your belly flop hit the earth from 2,000 feet. That's the bit we're a little worried about. In fact, there's no parachute and nothing, and you can't ring and say, steward. Yes, I've got a bit of an ache in my hang glider, and it's just a PAF feeling. But, you know, birds fly, but no one's ever put a flighted bird, a bird that can fly, in an aeroplane. I mean, that just birds would just find that so weird. You know, it'd be an amazing documentary. You know, bird flying along and looking at the aeroplane. Don't need to fly. Just stick my arms in. Hey, I can just balance on this chair, hey. Hello. Other birds flying outside the aeroplane. Hey, what's he doing inside? Hello. Oh. I'm sorry. Oh, the white wine, please.
That was Eddie Izzard with a piece called Parrots, taken from his CD Definite Article. Now on to my conversation with Sarasota Herald Tribune reporter Carlos Munoz about the tragic story of the manatee named Snooty and the controversy swirling around his death. I'd like to welcome Carlos Munoz to Talking Animals. Good morning, Carlos.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
So, I think Snooty's death became a international, really, news story, so I doubt most listening would be unfamiliar with what happened, but maybe you could just briefly outline the Snooty story from the birthday weekend and then what happened after.
All right, well, first of all, I think everybody looks forward to Snooty's birthday every year, and they have for quite a long time. He's been in captivity since 1948, and so they were celebrating his 69th birthday this year, July 21st. I think July 20th is when they held that media day. That's when media got a chance to go in there and take a few pictures because it gets pretty crowded on his actual birthday. It gives the public a better chance to view Snooty when there's not so many cameras around. So people got the chance to go in there, take some pictures, and then the next day the public came and you know, gave him his big vegetable cake on the lunch there. And then, surprisingly, I mean, the next day is when we heard about the events that led to his death, unfortunately.
And so, Carlos, what was that event that led to his death for people who may not know that part of the story?
Well, what we understand is that sometime overnight, I think museum officials finished up around 5 or 6 o'clock on his birthday. And then after that period, the manatees are pretty much left to their own. They're unsupervised. They just stay in their tank. They don't really do a whole lot. Manatees are pretty, pretty quiet animals. They just don't move around much at night. And somewhere in that morning period, a panel broke loose from the wall, fell off, allowing the manatees to get inside a compartment area that was housing the life support plumbing. And that room hadn't been opened, they said, in about 5 years, and Snooty had gone inside of it and was so large, and manatees aren't capable of swimming backwards. At least that's what they've determined, that manatees his size in the wild can't move backwards. And he became stuck in that compartment and was unable to get out. They said that when they found him the next morning, that the caretaker had seen the other manatees possibly swimming in and out of that compartment, but Snooty was still large. He wasn't able to get out. Mm. The other manatees, being 500-600 pounds, were half his size. They were able to either turn around or they were able to get back out of the compartment. Snooty obviously drowned in there. He's a marine mammal. He breathes air. They usually come up every 2 or 3 minutes for air, but they can be down there as long as 20 minutes. They estimate that he was down there about an hour and a half by the time they got to him, and at that point it was too late.
Yeah.
A 911 call was made to the fire department. The fire department came, and they apparently pulled him out and then brought him to the service.
Oh, geez. So on the heels of his birthday celebration, of course, this was kind of a head-snapping juxtaposition that this happened as soon as he died. But then it moved to an even kind of more jarring level, I guess, when this cause of death was revealed because, and help me if I'm getting this wrong, Carlos, but I guess many view that part with the grate or the thing falling off as negligence on the museum's part. Do I have that right or semi-right?
I think the public views it as negligence. I think the museum views it as an accident. The bolts that were on there, they had been on there for at least 5 years because that's the last time they checked it. Just looking at the panel, it appears that they're screwed into the fiberglass, and that fell loose. They're saying that basically that they had been checking that panel every day. They had actually had a USDA inspection in June where they come in, they look at the tank, they look at the facilities, and then they basically say, okay, and you get to keep your exhibit license in order to show wild animals because the other animals in the tank are rehab manatees, and those are covered by Florida Wildlife, so they have to follow certain rules in order to have them. So the tank was checked, and they said it was okay approximately June 5th when they had the inspection. But somewhere between that time and July 21st, that panel apparently shook loose and fell off.
So this is, I guess, the difference in perception that you've just described is what has sparked the protest that particularly happened last weekend. So, and as part of that, the protesters were calling for the firing of the museum's CEO and COO. Now, has there been a response from the museum to that part, or just explaining kind of what happened?
It was, actually. Right after the announcement of the protest, the South Florida Museum spokesperson, Jessica Schubeck, released a statement basically saying that, you know, there is going to be an evaluation of this. She isn't calling it an investigation. The South Florida Museum doesn't necessarily want a law enforcement agency to investigate this, but Florida Wildlife Commission is involved. Florida Wildlife Commission isn't going to conduct their own investigation, but they're being asked to, as a consultant, to give them a third party along with 17 other parties with the Manatee Rescue and Rehabilitation Partnership. And that group will give them a third party to evaluate the situation and find out what went wrong. I think that's the route they want to go.
So that sounds like the next key step in the story then is what they determine from their investigation.
Right. And, you know, they've been calling it an accident. The groups that are upset, obviously calling it negligence. There's a kind of like a gray area in there because Snooty wasn't covered by laws that are protecting manatees right now. There was the Manatee Sanctuary Act in effect in 1893. But after that, there wasn't much else that covered a manatee that old. You know, Snooty's age was amazing, but it was also a kind of a hindrance when it comes to his protection because he was grandfathered into most modern laws.
That is a tricky thing. Well, Carlos, I'm afraid we have reached the end of our timer, just about the end of the show, but thank you very much for joining us on Talking Animals. This is Carlos Munoz of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and we'll keep tracking the story and maybe have you back for an update, especially when that report is released.
All right. Sounds great.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have just about reached the end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next with Radioactivity. And kicking off a 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, midpoint with Nola Lalay at noon. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp and John Gilmore preside over executive session. And then again at 2 p.m., the music resumes with the Yikes. It's me sitting in for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music at 2 p.m. So this is Talking Animals. Next week, we're going to have a guest from a new app that connects dog owners with dog walkers. who are screened, insured, and bonded. And anyway, it's a whole story, and there's a whole interesting field there. Anyway, this is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for NPR News headlines and Rob with Radioactivity. Thanks.